Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, from the University of Exeter, which is in the United Kingdom, 2 hours a week is the key dose of nature for health and well-being. We got to spend more time outside, get our green moment. We're going to share a lot on health and healing today. Then we're going to take your calls. And our voicemail number is 862-800-6805. We're going to talk about life aboard a slave ship, just to give you historical perspective, to show you those who suffered, how much they suffered, and what I believe an obligation we have for understanding why we should at no time accept bigotry, prejudice, racism, and disrespect for other people's lives. And if there was a time when there was no respect for those other people's lives. Just part of our series to make us more aware. Also, we're going to get that in today about why millennials are struggling to pay their rent. I have some commentaries today, and I'm going to talk about why we're trying to sell our nuclear technology to the Saudis. Are you kidding? We shouldn't be selling them anything. But we are. And it's not just this president who's doing this. It's an entire industry, the military-industrial complex. So we'll explore that as well. That's our show. We begin by looking at what the University of Exeter has to say. And they're talking about how much time do we need to be around trees and grass and Mother Nature. This was a new large-scale study, and it was published in Scientific Reports, and it found that people who spend at least 120 minutes in nature a week are significantly more likely to report good health and higher psychological well-being than those who don't visit nature at all during an average week. So that's important. We need time outside. From Wageningen University, cacao, which is chocolate, and green tea can slash heart disease death by 40%. So long-term consumption of the chemical is epicatechin, E-P-I-C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N. That's a compound in green tea. By the way, it's also in apples and cacao, chocolate, can significantly boost heart health and reduce the risk of heart-related death. That is from the Netherlands. And that was a study over 25 years. We also found from the University of Washington that exposure to glyphosate, that's the pesticide in Roundup, increases the risk of cancer by more than 40%. And almost everybody they test and almost everybody that has this is at risk of cancer. So why don't we have a universal ban on it? Many countries have banned glyphosate. We have not. Because, well, we do not put the public's health first. Not when lobbyists, your legislators, member of Congress, and advertisers on television are making money from it. It's that simple. So the recent legal victories of people who develop cancer following glyphosate exposure have attracted a lot of headlines, as it should, with tens of millions of dollars being awarded to individuals and many others pending lawsuits, about 14,000 pending lawsuits. The good news is that those pending lawsuits are not against specifically Monsanto, the maker, but against Bayer that bought Monsanto. Its stock is down 47% and is going even further down. That's good. Then we go on and we find that one more reason to eat organic. Harvard University says that where we carry our fat on our body, our belly, our buttocks, our thighs, is linked to cancer risk. According to Harvard, in the first prospective study of directly measured body fat distribution and cancer risk, investigators found that higher levels of abdominal, meaning your belly, and thigh fat are associated with an increased risk of aggressive forms of cancer. It's not the amount of fat on your body, but where it's stored, that can increase your risk of heart attack and stroke and diabetes. And categorized by a number of physical traits, whether slim, athletic, or full, it's a good idea to figure out which body type you belong to and learn how to maximize your fitness level and appearance based upon your optimal shape. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer, a major peer-reviewed journal of the American Cancer Society, and the findings can lead to a better understanding of the relationship between obesity and prostate cancer and provide new insights for treatment. For example, if guys have a big pot belly, you're far more likely to have prostate cancer, and women more likely to have ovarian cancer and breast cancer. From Guangzhou University in China, published in the British Medical Journal, Complementary and Alternative Medicine, they found that the Japanese knotwood, knot, K-N-O-T-W-E-D, can inhibit the signaling and cell growth of hepatocellular carcinoma stem cells. You see, if you target the stem cancer cell, then it can stop all the other cancer cells after it. Just taking out a tumor without getting the stem cells mean that cancer can grow back. So researchers in China isolated and identified small molecule called STAT3 signaling inhibitors from the root extracts of the Japanese knotwood. And the results, which included the evaluation of in vitro anti-cancer activities of these STAT3 signaling inhibitors, were published in the peer-reviewed journal. So once again, what do we have here? First, we have something done by modern-day science in China and that supports traditional Chinese medicine using herbs and botanicals in ways that can help benefit in a functional manner. Functional foods means they function to help your body. Secondly, for those who've written against traditional Chinese medicine, like Wikipedia and its editors, they're simply wrong and they're biased. And also it shows that we should be putting more of our energy into understanding how nature can help us with cancer. Also today, an extra burger meal a day eats the brain away. Let me be clear on this. This is from the Australian National University. The average person eats many more calories than they did 50 years ago. You've seen the ads. The ads are that the more you give a person of something they like, the more likely they are to want to crave that. So today's burgers have to have a whole bunch of French fries on them, or deep-fried onion rings, and then bacon, and then cheeses and eggs. You've got four or five different cancer-causing agents on one burger, plus the burger itself, and then its temperature and grilling it. Then the buns, acrylamides, the browning of the bun. So it's nothing but a continuous intake of pro-inflammatory foods. Now, this was published in Frontiers Neuroendocrinology. And what it says very specifically is that when you have these extra fast food burger meals every day, which hundreds of millions of people in the United States do and around the world, it's having a devastating result for your brains and waistlines. Yeah. And the brain's health can decline much earlier in life than previously thought, due in large part to a society that promotes unhealthy lifestyle choices. A professor, Churbyun, from the Center for Research on Aging, says people are eating away at their brain with a really bad fast food diet and little to no exercise. So the next time and every time you see an ad for a burger, what if they showed you the scientific truth that when you eat the burger begins to eat your brain? Now, I do not ascribe people being limited in their intellect or, let's say, unable to understand just basic cognitive skills. That is also part of our conditioning, lack of real education, our desire to read and challenge ourselves. We we're just kind of getting by at the lowest possible level. Then you throw in a bad diet on top of it, then it's a problem. So you could say that the people today who are 30, based upon their lifestyles, highly sedentary, living their whole life up to that point with electromagnetic frequency radiation hitting their body, sleeping with cell phones on under their pillows, always having a laptop, not getting enough exercise, and not eating right, not detoxing, and not understanding the real life. I posted today, by the way, on my Facebook. I must have posted 100 things today. There were a lot. But there was one picture, and it says, this is the face of male, let's say, the toxic male masculinity that people believe that we should be fearing. And it was a bunch of young faces, 18, 19-year-olds, on the barge at Normandy Beach just before they were going to go right in to face death, where all those machine guns and barbed wire were there to prevent them from surviving on the beach. And you can only imagine the fear that they had in that moment, but the courage it took to be in that forward motion to go in, knowing that the first people on the beach were going to be the first people killed. And when you stop and think about who were the first responders, the men and women, the firefighters, New York City police, the ambulance people, think of the people who risked their lives. I was there. You could actually see a photograph. I don't know who took it, but someone actually took a photograph and sent it to our office of me running right outside the World Trade Center. I'd just gotten back that morning, and I'd gone for a run. I never in my life ran south on Riverside Drive. I always ran up to the George Washington Bridge, cross it, and back down. My one and only time, that's when I heard that plane, I said, that's too low. And I looked up and boom. In any case, I saw the people. I'm always seeing the people who are not afraid to put their own lives ahead of those that they're trying to save. So before you talk about male masculinity and how all men should be feminized, that somehow there's something wrong with being a man, where would you be on that barge? Oh, you wouldn't be on the barge, would you? No. None of the young people today would be on that barge. No, my God, the thought of being in conflict, they already would have been at their college in a room hugging bears. But there's a time when we need to understand what is uniquely masculine, what is uniquely feminine, and the good graces we have in understanding the best of each of us. Are there people who are excessive in women? You bet. We've all met them. And they should never be an example of what women could or should be. And the same is true for men. Now, do you then make a generalization that all men are toxic, and that just being a man is toxic, or just being white is toxic, or just being old is toxic? Think of talking about we can't vote for someone because they're an old white man. My God, how hypocritical can we be? That's ageism. That's bigotry. That's biased. So that means that we wouldn't be able to listen to Albert Schweitzer or Albert Einstein? We wouldn't. We wouldn't be able to go to a lecture on art from Picasso. I don't know how much dumber we have to be before we understand that we've allowed the wrong type of people to influence us for the moment and a half of media attention to make some stupid statement that then becomes a talking point that gets on everyone's website. It's just dumb. Anyhow, from the British Medical Journal, there is an article about increasing red meat, and it's linked with a heightened risk of death. Not disease, death. Quote, increasing red meat intake, particularly processed red meat, and haven't you all seen the pizza ads? The newest one is, we give you salami, and we give you beef, and we give you every type of meat, right? Is associated with a heightened risk of death. This is the British Medical Journal, just out today. However, reducing red meat intake while increasing healthy protein sources, whole grains, vegetables. Yeah, when I have my protein shake in the morning, I'm getting it from split pea protein. But you could get it from brown rice protein. That's healthy. That doesn't cause death. That causes a longer life. Reduces your risk. So the average American, the average graduate student, the average professor that teaches the student, the average provost, the average dean of academic affairs. Let me think, do I know one? Was one my friend until he died in a parking lot at Fairleigh Dickinson University? Yeah. Yeah. Did I ask him to give up on his junk food, to come and detoxify? Oh, he was going to do it when he retired. And he never reached retirement. Wow. Boy, do we make the wrong things more important in our lives. Couldn't give up the meat, and it increased your risk of heart attacks and diabetes, certain types of cancer, and always premature death. So just look at it this way. Every time you decide to eat meat, in that moment, you're Christopher Walken. You're in the deer hunter, in the final scene, in a Saigon bar. You're doped out. You're betting whatever money you have, and then you're putting a pistol to your head, grinning, and pulling a trigger. Of course, you're not going to have another shot at that when your brains are on a wall. He won an Academy Award for that. And today, metaphorically, we have people every single day shooting the heroin, shooting the crack, yeah, taking the drink. Well, it's a party, we have to drink. Okay, explain this to me. Why do you have to drink at a party? Why? I used to go to Studio 54 in New York, in the underground, and all the different clubs and dance, because I love the disco music and the upbeat nature of the people. It's just wonderful. I drank mineral water. All my friends did the same thing. What would be the difference drinking mineral water and drinking vodka? They both taste the same. One's just slightly bitter. And you couldn't tell the difference if you had a $900 bottle of vodka versus a $2 bottle of mineral water. We just live this stupid life of illusion. Well, you don't have to be drunk in order to have a good time. And if you do, then you don't have an authentic life and you better get some therapy. And there it is. So when we risk our life by eating meat, one day we're not going to be given another chance. That's the unfortunate part of it. Also, sea buckthorn, which is easy to find, by the way. It's a compound that shows eye health support from China Agricultural University. Why? Because there's chemicals in there called PACs. Those are proanthocyanidins. And from sea buckthorn seeds, they can protect the retinas from harmful light effects. And that's good. So get your sea buckthorn from any health food store and help protect your eyes. Also, Artemisia capillaris, well, wormwood, how about that, is found to stimulate mineralization of your bone and prevent bone loss. From the South Korean Institute of Oriental Medicine, published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine, they found that wormwood has a good effect upon remineralization of your bones. And when you consider how many postmenopausal people in society have very porous bones, and it's not that they fall and break their hip cracks and they fall. And people die from that. So capillary wormwood extract is significantly suppressed osteoclast formation from bone marrow macrophages. In simple language, wormwood helps you have stronger bones. And exercising can be different in its effects if you do it in the morning or in the evening. The University of Copenhagen, according to them, researchers from the university have learned that the effects of exercise can differ depending upon the time of day it's performed. For example, exercising in the morning results in an increased metabolic response to skeletal muscles, while exercising later in the day increases energy expenditure for an extended period of time. So hence, overall better for us, better for our circadian rhythms, and better for our metabolism, exercise in the morning. And that's the latest on health and healing. And by the way, if you're over the age of 50, according to Trinity College in Dublin, you have a very high likelihood of having vitamin D deficiency. And that's not good for your heart, your brain, your immune system. So make sure you're getting that. And the University of Magala in Spain is showing that the more mobile phone, cell phone use you have, you can develop new pathologies, a whole lot of new pathologies. And if you're using intravenous vitamin C on viral myocarditis in children, it's very beneficial, according to Tianjin University in China. So if you have a child suffering from viral myocarditis, intravenous vitamin C be just the ticket. We are 21 minutes into our program. I'm going to take a break and come right back and go right into your questions. Please stay with us.
Hi, Gary. My question is in regards to high cholesterol, natural way to resolve those issues.
Just high cholesterol. Okay, well, there's a lot you can do if you have an elevated cholesterol. First, understand that many people have elevated cholesterol because they are not watching their diet. They have way too many fats, including saturated fats and trans fats. So I believe that people should take the time to go on a plant-based vegan diet. That's the very best thing that I could suggest for dropping down your elevated cholesterol level. Now, there's some things you can do. For example, the more salads you eat, the more green vegetables you have, that also helps you with cholesterol as well. So get off the saturated fat, get off the standard American diet. And then I would suggest vitamin C, B-complex, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10 are all good. And also garlic and onion, your sulfurs. Now, your sulfurs smell, and they don't taste good. And that's why we love the smell and taste of garlic when we're eating it. We just don't always like the aftertaste and smell. But you start taking something like, let's say, alpha-lipoic acid. It has sulfur in there. And B-complex has sulfur. That's very good for you. And it's good for the cholesterol level as well. All right? That's where I would start. And you do that for at least 60 days. For 2 months, go on a healthy plant-based diet. No sugars. Make sure you're exercising. That brings down your cholesterol level. Also, make sure that you're taking the tocotrienols and tocopherols, about 800 units of tocopherols and 200 units of tocotrienols. That's a part of the fractionalized vitamin E complex. Vitamin D3 can also help. And the mineral magnesium is important, about 800 milligrams a day, 400 in the morning, 400 in the evening. Same with calcium. Probiotics are very good also for bringing down cholesterol level, and having lots of fiber in the diet is one of the very best things you can do, about 30 to 40 grams of fiber a day from mixed cereal grains and vegetables and fruits. That's terrific for lowering cholesterol out of the body. Okay, we'll take another call.
Good afternoon. Hi, Gary. My name is Chris. I'm from the state of Maryland. I'm calling about kidney health. I don't really hear much about kidney health and how we can keep our kidneys healthy and how we can keep them from failing. Thank you.
All right, well, several things we can do to protect our kidneys. The very first thing, one of the most important things you can do is get off all of your high fructose corn syrup products. They're really terrible for kidneys. I would give up all alcohol because every time you have a glass of alcohol, and again, people think, well, if I don't drink a lot of alcohol, I'm just socially drinking. I'm not getting drunk. I wrote a book on this, and now science, 40 years later, is supporting it. There is no such thing as a safe level of alcohol. None. So we want to make sure that we're protecting the kidneys at all costs, and that's the first thing we can do. Now, what do the kidneys do? Why do we need two kidneys? Well, we need it because everything that goes in the body ultimately has to be metabolized and used, and then the byproduct comes out. No different than in the morning. You eat a good meal at night, and you pass it in the morning. That's dead cells, oligocellulose, and bacteria. So the kidneys take the waste products out of the body, and that helps take the kidneys. And especially if you are adequately hydrated, water is one of the best things in the world for the kidneys. And green juices like celery cucumber juice with lemon, apple cider vinegar, a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar, a teaspoon of lemon, and a teaspoon of ginger in a 16-ounce glass of celery and cucumber juice is one of the best single things for flushing the kidneys, giving your kidneys a flush. And there are a number of different renal, which is kidney, problems. Heavy metals like lead, cadmium, solvents, different types of toxins that we bring into our body. And all that can lead to problems. And it's not uncommon for people with congestive heart failure, diabetes, or chronic hypertension or lupus to end up with kidney disease. Now, Bright's disease, B-R-I-G-H-T-S, is a kidney condition by the presence of blood protein in the urine. So we need to keep the kidneys clean, and flushing them with clean water on a regular basis is crucial to this. Also, a healthy plant-based diet is crucial for healthy kidneys. And when you have a high-protein diet, or when you eat any animal protein, one of the byproducts is arachidonic acid. And arachidonic acid is a very toxic, highly pro-inflammatory type of breakdown product. When you have any kind of hamburger, hot dog, chicken, you have a byproduct of urea and ammonium. Those are toxic to the kidneys. In renal tubular acidosis, the kidneys fail to absorb bicarbonate normally, causing impaired ammonia production and acid secretion. So you end up with acidosis and potassium depletion. And nephrotic syndrome is not a disease, but it can be a sign that you're eating a lot of protein, high protein diets. A lot of people I counsel are athletes are really in trouble because their kidneys have been overwhelmed with so much protein byproduct. So I start off by suggesting good probiotics, good bacteria, 3 times a day, maybe 5 billion, 3 times a day, or 15 billion probiotics per day. That helps. Also, coenzyme A, vitamin B6, vitamin C. Vitamin C is very important for the kidneys. And L-arginine and methionine, 2 times a day. Potassium, that acts as a kidney stimulant. It's needed for nephritis conditions. Vitamin A is very important, generally at higher doses. And a B-complex, starting at 100 milligrams, and zinc. And BUCHA, B-U-C-H-U-T, is good. And cranberries. Cranberries contain natural chemicals that acidify the urine and destroy bacteria buildup that ends up causing kidneys problems. So cranberries are good. Dandelion extract is good for kidneys. And there is an herb called hydrangea, H-Y-D-R-A-N-G-E-A, and Uva, U-V-A, Ursi, U-R-S-I, really good for your kidneys. And also corn silk is good. And I would put juniper berries and marshmallow, that's marshmallow, root is good as well. And try to have more raw food in the diet. I suggest about 60% raw food, bananas, celery, garlic, papaya, including the papaya seeds, by the way, watercress, watermelon. They're all good for your kidneys. Okay? All right, that's all we have time for on that. Now we're going to go right over to our audio file, and let's hear why millennials are struggling to pay their rent.
Rent, it's too damn high.
Millennials know it all too well.
I thought that with my new Boston salary that I was, you know, going to be living large, was in for a rude awakening.
I'm paying three times what I paid in Oklahoma for half the space.
I'm technically like one paycheck away from homelessness, which if you think about that, that's really messed up.
In the US, millennials paid a median rent total of $97,400 in 2017 alone. Rising rent comes down to high housing prices. As the cost of a home skyrockets, affluent would-be homeowners are turning to the rental market and pushing out those with lower incomes.
While there is a high demand for more housing, and while developers are reacting to that, the only things I really see going up are high-end luxury apartments and condos.
Millennials are making big sacrifices to make up the difference.
I have to live check to check.
Going home to see my family more in Michigan, that's not an option.
Do I really need to go to the doctor for a physical this year?
They're scrapping their savings too.
The older generation, like Gen X and above, they've always pressured us to like have a savings account and save for retirement, and they've been telling me that since like I was a child, and I literally like I can't do that right now.
I'm not saving as much as I want to. You know, I don't feel like I have as great of a financial base as my parents did when they were my age.
Cutting costs comes with a price tag of its own.
It's just knowing that one unexpected bill or an accident or anything that is out of the ordinary and unexpected that could cost you something could potentially mean you might not be able to make rent.
Your input as well at this time. We have a talkback number, and that's 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. I'm going to try to take some, but not all, the pieces, because it's a very complex problem. Let me just focus upon some of the pieces that we generally don't think about when we're talking about the struggles of many millennials. First and foremost, they're not all selfish. They're not all narcissistic. They're not all spoiled. A lot of them are just very conscientious. They're trying to cope. They're trying with limited resources to make the best choices in life. And then you have those who don't generally make their own choices. They're made for them and have been throughout their life. These are the so-called helicopter parents. And a helicopter parent, though they can come from many different backgrounds, more often than not today are professional parents. I've interviewed them. I've counseled them. And at some point when everything begins to crash and burn, that's the only time they wake up to how much they've contributed to the crisis in other people's lives, like their children. For example, if you have a mother and father who are both professionals, the question is not do they deserve, you know, the rewards for their professional work ethics and their hard studies. Yes, they do. And let's say you have a father that's a physician and a mother who's an attorney. I'm actually referring to a couple that I know. They have three children. It wasn't would their children go to the same schools they went to, Ivy League schools, but they couldn't just go. They had to have their own private apartment. They didn't want to stay on campus. They had to have allowances. They had to be able to socialize. They had to be able to travel. So what it would cost them per year is about $100,000 per child when it's all in, tuition, which could go $60,000, then living expenses. Now, the average family cannot afford $60,000 a year to spend to send someone to college, but a professional can. The difference is, depending upon what profession that profession's in and how much of a cash income they have, but what we know today is that most people who are making a certain amount of money are spending that exact amount or more. So even though they are considered the elite of society, they're also in debt up to their eyeballs. They're not the millionaire class. That means having $1 million that doesn't even include your real estate. So we have a lot of those people, tens of millions. So those people are not going to be concerned about what it costs to live in Los Angeles. Their parents can afford to buy them a house or a condo. Now, there are certain places that the real estate market has just exploded. New York City and its surrounding suburbs, especially Brooklyn. All of Los Angeles and all of California, Northern California, especially up around San Francisco and the whole valley and across the bay, Marin County and north. Chicago, Miami, Houston are also examples of this. Atlanta is also another example. So historically, where you could have been a middle-class person, gone to a state school, got out of school with little to no debt, because most state schools were free. You didn't pay for your tuition, but you paid for room and board if you lived on campus or in the near neighborhood and your books, etc. But you could manage that. And historically, there'd be multiple jobs when you got out. Today, they're not. So they're not even planning properly and looking ahead and saying, what is the likelihood that visas from educated students from other countries who have higher academic grades and are willing to work for one-third the salary of an American, because they are scooping up a lot of the jobs that historically have been thought to be the revered jobs, meaning seniority jobs. Oh, there's Mary. Mary makes $150,000 a year. It's not a lot of money, not after you've worked for 30 years. But now Mary, this is a young man who's from South Korea. Mary is 55, and she still has a child in college, and she's divorced, and she has a lot of expenses, a lot of overhead, but she can handle it. And this young man, you're going to train to do your work over the next 6 months, and then you're gone. No more benefits, nothing. And he's going to start at $35,000 a year and no benefits, and that's what corporate America is doing. It's gutting the seniority ranks in order to increase the value of the company stock. And with this latest tax break, they were able to take in billions of dollars and buy back their own stock. Let me explain how it works. Let's, for argument's sake, say that the stock in a company is at $1,000 a share. That'd be very high. Now, because you have hundreds of millions of shares that people have purchased. So you get a tax break. Now you can, instead of paying that money in taxes, you can buy back the stock, what is called treasury stock. So you're buying back the company's own stock. So when you buy back millions upon millions of shares, let's say you buy $5 billion of your own stock back, that means there's less stock in the market, which means that there's a greater value on the stock that you have. Therefore, everybody who bought back that stock, now their value, their stock has gone up substantially. And here's the idea. Where did that money go? You paid your own company to buy back your stock. And now your company's stock, or the stockholders, and now you get more money. So now if you can bring an automation that can do the work of your legal department, and that's what they're doing now. The legal profession is a dead profession in the future. There will always be the what are called the white glove law firms that work for lobbying groups and certain industries because they know the intricacies of how to defend them and how to lobby on their behalf in antitrust suits and other suits. But for rank and file law, it's over. Automation and artificial intelligence can do all that. And at least 22 different professions are historically now no longer sustainable. there are professions that are growing, like in, I've mentioned them, medicine and nursing and care for the elderly, et cetera. But you're taking about 50% of all potential jobs and you're eliminating, you're wiping them out. But you didn't tell the student, you didn't tell the parents, you didn't sit and think. You were more interested in which college you, all my friends are going to this one, I'm going to go to, we're all going to go together. And exactly what are you supposed to take? Well, that's irrelevant. It's not irrelevant. You'd be better off knowing what you're going to take and matching that with, are there going to be jobs? So when I get out of college, I'll have a job. And then you start looking at, why does it cost so much to go to college? And then we start seeing it's because of greed in politics. You're not getting a better education by paying more money for it. Do you think you actually get a better education at Harvard, Yale, Brown, and University of Pennsylvania, University of Chicago, Stanford, than a regular state school? That's a myth. You don't. It's all an illusion. And then they have these big tax-free funds that they have, but they don't pay off the student debt. So first, no one should go to college unless they ask themselves, let me do my homework. Now, the good thing about the younger generation, they're very savvy at doing research on the Internet. They can do that about five times faster than an older person can because it's where they live. If you don't find that there's an abundance of jobs in the field that you're going to be going in, don't go into that one. Don't go to that school. You may want to go to a trade school. You may want to go to a different kind of college. But then should we be able to have 40 million, that's how many people have student debt today, 40 million young people are burdened with debt, and that debt, 40% of that debt belongs to the federal government. The federal government could easily forgive that debt. In fact, we could forgive all debt, and nothing would go wrong. Now, we gave $1.5 trillion in tax breaks to the rich with the false premise, both Democrats and Republicans, that it's going to trickle down. There is no such thing as trickle down. There has never been trickle down. It's a myth. Those who get the money keep it and spend it. Look at the latest bailout during the 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 with quantitative easing at $90 billion a month. That money never stopped a homeowner from being foreclosed on. It never went to help a small business. It never built an infrastructure. It went to companies so they could buy their competition because they were paying zero interest for that money. It was a fraud. The Federal Reserve is a fraud. Our entire banking system is corrupt. So now the student not only has got to pay back the debt, but doesn't have a job to do it. And that creates depression and anxiety. But also, there's going to be compounding interest, which means you're going to pay twice or three times what the original debt was. You owed $60,000, now you're going to owe $180,000. So what we should do first and foremost is we should have a national campaign to strike every college teacher, every professor, adjunct, or anyone else on the faculty, including tenured. All teachers in all high schools should go on strike. We should have a 1 week of complete strike and every student until the federal government is forced to forgive all student debt and start from scratch. That way, at least we're helping these young people when they need it the most. Now, the answer to the second question, where should I live? Well, don't live in a city that you can't afford. You see, New York used to be a wonderful place to live. I've lived there for a half a century. I raised my daughter on 89th Street between Riverside Drive and Weston Avenue in a tiny little apartment. I paid $47 a month rent. Today, a one-bedroom can go for $2,980, according to a report I saw on Sunday, for one bedroom. 51% of all the people working or living in New York City are at the poverty or below the poverty line. So you got really two classes. You used to have five classes of people living in New York, economic classes. Now you have two. You have the rich, and you have those who are working for the rich. And it's not the right place to be. So there are many great places in this country where you could live, where you could actually afford to live. And I'm not talking about living out in Oklahoma or Nebraska or Iowa, the corn states. You just can't live in one of the metropolitan areas because you're just going to be paying a lot. And you should never pay more than 20% of your income on living expenses. When you're doing that, then you're cheating yourself. And that's not going to stop. Now, that gives me another point of view, and the other point of view is that should we as human beings be concerned about where we're living, what it's costing, how much we're making, and what other people are not able to make to live in the same area and share the same experiences? What's the point of living right near Broadway in Hell's Kitchen on the Middle West Side in the 50s and 40s, 10th, 11th, 12th Avenue, 9th Avenue? You can't afford to go to a Broadway show that's just two blocks away from where you live. Can't afford it. What's the point of living in a place where you can't afford to eat in the better restaurants? So there's a certain point to where you realize I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I don't have the right support system. Rich kids don't have to worry about that. The professional class don't have to worry about that. Everyone else does. And everyone else is the majority of Americans. So don't be afraid to look at other wonderful places in America to live. But shouldn't we ask ourselves this? Isn't it all of our responsibility to look at what's happening to other people who cannot afford what we can and ask, should we continue to be silent about income inequality as if it's a non-issue when it's a very important issue that's not being addressed on by anyone? Because the establishment, whether it's left or right, is irrelevant. The establishment, the corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans, are still the establishment, the deep state, the corporatization of American values, the ones who hold the keys to the propaganda machine. So these are just some of the points of reference that we should be examining. I don't see any calls up online. So when you do have a call or an issue you'd like to share about why we have so many young people who are struggling, and I don't believe they should, and we should be helping them, call in our voicemail and leave your comments. Here's the number, 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. We're going to go to our guest in a second here. I just want to mention that a week from Sunday, I'm going to be doing the most comprehensive, in-depth lecture I've ever done, a webinar, so people all over the world can tune in. It'll be, I don't know how long it's going to take. When I get rolling, I give a lot of information. And the goal is, can we reverse age-related illnesses that are not actually age-related, but are ageism-related, meaning our lifestyle choices, our behavior have created the diseases we're now suffering from, and the older we get, the more these we have, when there shouldn't be any diseases associated with aging. Can we add years back to our life? And the answer is yes. How many? I've come up with a new formula that I believe we could add 30 high-quality, healthy years of life, even at 70, 75, which means that if we did things right over a three-year period, based upon the protocols I'm going to be giving, if you're 60, you should be the new 40. If you're 50, you should be the new 35. If you're 70, you could easily be the new 50. Big changes. This has never been done before. I've never done it before, and I know no one else has, and I spent my life in anti-aging medicine as director of anti-aging medicine. The Institute of Applied Biology did all this research. I've done 40 clinical studies, so I know what causes us to age and what we can do to de-age. So go to GaryNall.com or go to PRN.FM and get the information. Sign up. A week from Sunday, not this Sunday, the following Sunday at noon, it begins. And our bandwidth always is full, so you won't want to miss this. And also, we're still interviewing for young idealistic lawyers to do research because we're going after some big people. And it begins. And down, so if we're also looking for office managers, citizen journalists, these are paying jobs. You can call our number, 646-926-5422. These are positions more for idealists, people who really are not afraid of taking on the inequality of life and bringing justice to it. Also, read my latest article challenging Wikipedia. It's 40 pages long. It's an entire indictment against the fraud of them being objective and fair and scholarly. They're none of the above. and we have 52 more articles in the process of being written, and our campaign begins next Monday, as you will see. Let's now take a quick break, and we're going to come back and go right over to our guest. In fact, let's not waste time. Let's say hello to Amy Jean Davis from Burbank, California. She's an animal rights and vegan lifestyle advocate, a spokesperson for the National Animal Save Movement, and founder of Los Angeles Animal Save Chapter. By the way, that movement is a collective of local grassroots groups dedicated to raising awareness about the plight of farm animals and to help and counsel people to become vegan. There are over 560 groups in the United States, Canada, Europe, UK, and Southeast Asia, Mexico, and Latin America. And she's also co-founder of the Love Always Sanctuary, a vegan animal sanctuary in the San Francisco area. And she co-produced the documentary Earthlings, very good documentary. And she holds degrees in public horticulture from Purdue University. And she also was a part of Colin Campbell's program at Cornell University. And her website is thesavemovement.org. And it's nice to have you with us today, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy, I'd like for you to draw a connection between animal rights today, which are vastly different than centuries ago because of the conditions of our animal livestock industry, where there were no threats of climate change then, and the need for more people to adopt a vegan lifestyle. Take your time.
Yes, well, we know that animal agriculture creates more greenhouse gases than the transportation sector globally. And when you take into consideration the greenhouse gases that are expelled from the animals as well, instead of just the transportation involved in animal agriculture. So we take into account the methane and the carbon dioxide from the animals and their byproducts. It's almost half of all greenhouse gas emissions. Now, people don't usually think about this when they're eating their hamburgers and their steaks or drinking their milk or they're eating their ice cream, but this is it's an unavoidable fact of the carbon and methane footprint of those food products. And when we look at the numbers, maybe that will make it a little more clear. We have 70 billion livestock bred and slaughtered every year on this planet. Now, we don't even have 8 billion people yet, but we have 70 billion land animals that we are bringing into existence. These animals eat a lot of food, drink a lot of water, create a lot of waste, and a lot of greenhouse gases. And so, a long time ago, there wasn't this incredible amount of animals being bred and slaughtered. And that has really changed the atmosphere, the greenhouse gas levels. So, and this affects everything. It affects everyone and everything because the earth is a closed ecosystem. So what we do in one area is eventually going to find its way to the other area. When it requires 25 pounds of grain to produce one edible pound of beef, we are misusing our resources and we're not being good stewards of the land. And we have almost a billion people on this planet that go to bed starving or hungry every single night, most of them being children, but we're still eating these products where it's 25 pounds of grain to 1 pound of edible beef. And the implications there for how it affects our health is a whole nother facet to the negative impact that animal agriculture has on the planet. The way that animal agriculture affects people in low-income communities where most of the factory farms are, people that live in food deserts where the only access to food are liquor stores and convenience stores. They don't have access to fresh produce and they don't have the means to go to travel to the grocery stores that have the fruits and vegetables. And so then they eat these terrible foods, processed foods, packaged foods, animal products, and then they get sick. And then, of course, we don't have an equal healthcare system in this country. So if they even have health insurance, it's probably not going to be, of the best kinds. That's going to cover for everything that they might need to see a doctor for. And so then these people
are going to be getting type 2 diabetes and cancer, and they're not going to be able to afford treatment. The injustices against the workers. The USDA says that 78% of the workforce at these factory farms and slaughterhouses are undocumented workers, people born of another country and aren't necessarily documented yet. Yet we want to build a wall to keep these people out. How many of us want to sign up to go work in a factory farm or a slaughterhouse? I don't think people understand that these farms are not just a bunch of happy animals that are being born and raised and then going off to slaughter. No, these animals are sick, and they're given 80% of the antibiotics that we use in this country. And even with all that medication, there's still some that get sick, and so they have to be culled. They call it culling, C-U-L-L-I-N-G. So they go through their farms, their factory farms, each day, multiple times a day, and they find the sick, injured, dying ones, and they have to cull them from the herd. They have to kill them. Nobody wants these jobs. These are awful jobs. They're dirty jobs. These animals are stressed. They're not happy. And nobody wants to work in a slaughterhouse, of course. And the people that do want to work in a slaughterhouse, of course, we question their mental capacities, their level of mental health. There's no right way to do the wrong thing. And we haven't even gotten to the ethical side of animal agriculture as it relates to the animals themselves. Of course, in America, we love our dogs and cats, and we have laws in place. You can break a car window in the state of California to rescue a dog inside on a hot day. Yet these animals are transported across the country, no food, no water, in a metal semi-trailer, in their own feces, and desperately thirsty and hot, and they're piled on top of each other, especially the animals that are closer to the cab of the truck where the fuel tanks are. You have to put more animals there so that the semi-trailer doesn't go off the road because it's unbalanced. And these animals are pigs, are cows, are chickens, are turkeys. They're no different than the dogs and cats that we love and have laws to protect. They're no different in their capacity to suffer. They're no different in their capacity to bond with their families. And when they're treated the same way we treat our dogs and cats, they respond in the same way. They're very loving. In fact, the cows are so docile that's a big reason why we chose to domesticate them in the first place, because they're easy to handle. And when you...
Amy, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm going to invite you back for a longer segment on our progressive commentary hour, which is a full hour. But at least people have a chance to be introduced to you, and they can look up the savemovement.org for more information. So we'll have you back in the next week for a full hour. Amy Jean Davis, out in Burbank, California, helping save animal lives and helping encourage a vegan diet. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you for having me, Gary. Have a great day.
We'll have her back for a full hour next week. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful day.